Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. And welcome to Bookworm. Today I have as my guest Elif Batuman. She was with us when her first book, a book of essays called The Possessed, came out. Now, no slacker in her pursuit of Dostoevskian titles, she's written a novel, her first novel. It's called The Idiot. It has an absolutely beautiful pale pink cover. An art teacher who, looking at the portfolio of the main character, yeah, says, aren't these a little girlish?
Yeah.
And she answers, well, it's not so long ago that I was a little girl.
Yeah, but for me, it is a long time ago. I'm going to turn 40 in a couple months, and this is the first novel, and I saw the pink, and I thought, you know, because there's a lot of pink in the book, too, in that art class where the teacher calls her little girlish. She ends up doing a whole project that involves covering her room with bright pink
paper. That's right. A pink hotel.
Yeah, it's to look like a pink hotel. Actually, a lot of the book was about her. I mean, the reason that pink hotel was this oppressive place, not the reason why, because of course, like all things in books, it's overdetermined. But one of the interpretations for that is how constrained she felt by femininity and girlishness and all of these things that you're supposed to do, and by the romance plot.
And by being caught there in her freshman year at Harvard as an 18-year-old who's been in certain ways, the book is very careful about keeping this subtle, but she's been put into connection with other students, young people, who are the children of immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a crazy sense in which Harvard is calibrating them,
yes,
as having something to teach one
to
another.
Teach each other, yes.
Yes.
That was very much my experience there, too.
Fascinating. But it's very interesting to meet Svetlana, who is Serbo-Croatian, because it wasn't yet Serbian.
Yeah, she's Yugoslavian.
Yes. And all of these friends, Ivan, who is Hungarian,
mm-hmm,
and who, in all of his ways, the heroine discovers, Hungarian to the core.
Yeah, well, It's a huge part of his identity in a way that it isn't for her, because she grew up in America, or her roommates. Her roommate is Korean-American. And like, he talks about it all the time, and he's going to Hungary over the summer. And she kind of thinks that if she goes to Hungary, she'll learn more about what he's like. Like, that's just a country that's like him because he's Hungarian.
And she's Turkish.
And she's Turkish, yeah.
By descent. Born in America.
Yeah, she's born in America. So in a way, it means more to the Hungarians than it does to her. I mean, of course, it means a lot to her, too, but it means something very different to the Hungarians. So she goes to Hungary and finds, of course, that it's not a country all related to this one guy who she happens to have a crush on. It's this whole place full of people who all have their own concerns, and they want things, or they want to give her things, and yeah.
Now, what's her name?
Selin.
The young women in the book are not sure, it's a subject for discussion, that they're going to have sex, mm-hmm, while in college.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you'll pardon me, but I think some of the readers of the book didn't understand. They say that they found the book very frustrating. Well, what they're finding frustrating is the fact that our heroine is very attracted to a man, but doesn't know how to manifest that attraction, mm-hmm, and doesn't know how to withdraw appropriately from physical attentions that don't, at this point, interest her.
That's one way of looking at it. I think it's there are these narratives about courtship and about marriage that, and you know, even from so this is 1995 that this book is set in. So even that's my age. I was a freshman in 1995, and even my parents' generation, courtship followed a much more set narrative. So there are these girls who get to college, and they're super aware, especially the ones from other countries, that they have so many opportunities that weren't available to women in other generations, to women, other women in their families, and that for them, their life is not really going to be about finding a man, and that's not going to be the be-all and the end-all. And yet, what has replaced it? Everyone is still talking. The first thing that anyone asks the main character is, do you have a boyfriend? Like, it's still so clearly, in some way, the most important thing. For many book reviewers today, it's still the most important thing. That pressure is something that I wanted to describe, and that pressure that doesn't necessarily have an immediate answer, that the girls don't necessarily know how to respond to. Nothing has substituted, has come and filled in that vacuum yet. And of course she's human. She feels biological drives, and Selin is a reader, so she has been reading all of these books, and she's a romantic, and she's in a way looking for romance, but she knows that it can't define her, and that if she does let it define her, it's defeated her in some way. So she's in a very precarious situation.
Now, you've then presented a book that has only one tip-off mm-hmm. point, mm-hmm. and that's in the epigraph from Proust. I wonder, would you read that passage? It's so perfectly profound in relation to the book. I'm talking to Elif Batuman about her book, The Idiot.
But the characteristic feature of the ridiculous age I was going through, awkward indeed, but by no means infertile, is that we do not consult our intelligence, and that the most trivial attributes of other people seem to us to form an inseparable part of their personality. In a world thronged with monsters and with gods, we know little peace of mind. There is hardly a single action we perform in that phase which we would not give anything in later life to be able to annul. Whereas what we ought to regret is that we no longer possess the spontaneity which made us perform them. In later life, we look at things in a more practical way, in full conformity with the rest of society. But adolescence is the only period in which we learn anything.
I'm amazed at how accuracy is the hallmark of the Proustian analysis.
Yeah.
So when I read that phrase, I didn't remember this passage. It was wonderful to see it. But yes, when I was young, I thought these trivial behaviors, mm-hmm. particularly of older people,
exactly.
were their most crucial definers.
Yeah.
And then you get older and see, no, you just caught them at a bad moment, at an irrelevant moment.
Yeah, or you think that everything that everyone else says is like a pure expression of their being and of the like of what their deeply held beliefs, and then that only you are this person in flux who's kind of like spitballing all the time. So actually, I wrote this book. This is one of those books that's been in a drawer for a long time, only it wasn't in a drawer. It was in the cloud. It was in Google Drive. So I wrote it when I was right after I started graduate school, so in my early 20s, and I reread it in my late 30s. And that's actually when I was rereading Proust, and I saw that passage, and I saw how it applied, and I understood that whole kind of gods and monsters aspect in a way that I hadn't necessarily at the time.
It's a very moving book because, on the one hand, it can be read as a coming-of-age novel, but on the other hand, it's a book whose narrator confides to us about the experience she's had. I did not learn a thing. And presumably she knows that now and expects to learn something. And I gather you're writing a sequel, am I right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am.
In which she learns?
Well, I'm actually, so the way that I ended up rediscovering this manuscript, I was working on a book that was also going to be autobiographical-like or based on my own sphere of experiences, but set in 2010. So it was going to be about a Turkish-American writer for a New Yorker-like publication living in Istanbul and in her 30s, experiencing all the compromises of adult life. And I found myself writing flashbacks to earlier points as if to explain those compromises through some earlier point in time. And those flashbacks just kept going further into the past. And at some point, I found the book was overdue and I was in trouble and I was on a fellowship. I was actually in Italy, in Tuscany, like surrounded by pug dogs. I found myself writing a flashback to when this character was in college. And then I was like, why am I trying to remember college like a chump when I wrote a whole book about it? So that's when I looked up this old manuscript. And I saw that in all kinds of ways, the book that I was writing, even though it was this book about this ignorant and very innocent person who hasn't really had to make a lot of compromises yet, a lot of the compromise, like the beginnings of it were already there. And I could see why the flashback had made me come back to this material. And I could see that it was about the same person. And that actually really helped me because the character in The Idiot, Selin, she felt like a fictional character to me because she was 18. And by the time I was, you know, revising the manuscript, I was 38 and we're different people. But I could see that she was going to turn into the person who was in the, you know, autobiographical book that I was writing.
Well, it's fascinating because the book that you were writing.
Yeah.
And she was the narrator, I assume. She would never have called it The Idiot.
No, she would never have called it The Idiot.
And the book very much is about seeing the title in relation to the blunders of a young woman in Harvard, full of the shared puffed up quality. Mm-hmm. They're all saying things like, my mother didn't spend the money to send me to Harvard to become a mime. Yeah. You know, they're very proud to be in Harvard.
Yeah.
They have a very arrested and pompous sense of who they are. And sometimes they're right. Sometimes they are hugely amusing. I found Svetlana a very amusing character. Others are incredibly annoying in their desire to direct and transform the people around them. But it is a book about being a very bright young person, too bright to be easily corrected in her errors of ways, and therefore a very funny book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the title, The Idiot, definitely came later. And when I was revising the draft, the greater part of the revision consisted of taking out all of the things that I'd written at age 23 with, you know, 1 year of grad school and a certain critical vocabulary, taking out that whole tissue of the wiser, older person who was like, you know, directing everything and stepping in to be like, oh, you know, when we're young, we're so foolish. And when we're older, we realize. And then when I was rereading it, yes, Svetlana really made me laugh. And all of the visceral moments of the awkwardness of youth seemed really real to me. And that was what I wanted to preserve. That's why I called it The Idiot.
She's in love with a young Hungarian man mm-hmm. named Ivan. He goes to Hungary for the summer. Mm-hmm. She agrees to participate in a...
in an English teaching program.
In Hungary.
Yeah, in Hungary.
And it's with the idea that the character, the idiot, the heroine of Elif Batuman's new book, will be able to see him on the weekends. And everyone tells her, 5 weeks in a Hungarian village is not going to be your idea of a good time.
Yeah.
But there are good times mm-hmm. at first. Mm-hmm. Then it becomes clear she hasn't been brought there to teach. She's been brought there to be put on display like a prize cow. Here is our English speaker, and let us serve you our dinner and our local dishes, and you stay in my house. I'm learning to become an English teacher. And she has relatively little contact with the children. she's becoming a model for what someone from the United States acts like. And she doesn't get to see Ivan very often, but more than that, when she arrives, she doesn't even feel like calling him.
Well, I think that the people in the Hungarian village, I wouldn't say that they had that there was some kind of trick or that she wasn't actually there for the children. And I kind of think that it's the same with the overblown kids at Harvard who are like, my parents didn't send me here to become a mime. Everyone is just so conscious of the rarity of the opportunities that they have that she goes to this village and people are like, oh my God, there's an American here. What are we going to do to make the best use of this American person? Okay, you take them for 1 week. I'm going to take her for another week. Now she's going to be with the kids. Now take her. Go take her to this camp. Okay, put her there. Wait, she's going to get bored. Give her some snacks. Show her the art. Like it, I don't know. I guess I had sort of a more, everyone's just running around in this confusion to make the most out of everything. And I guess the reason that she doesn't call him, I didn't really think of it that she gets there and she doesn't get a chance to see him. I thought of it as she goes there and she sees him at the beginning and he says something to her that he says, have a good time, go make friends with the other kids, have a good time in the villages, and the other kids are going to be the ones who are going to help you if you have a problem in the villages. And she hears that, and that kind of triggers this whole idea to her that she has, that you're not supposed to do things because of a man. Like, you're supposed to have adventures because you're having adventures, not because, even though she knows that she only went to Hungary because of this guy, some part of her is like, but I really have to be in it for the experience that it is itself. But of course, the experience that it is itself is so complicated for everyone who's there and for her that it's not legible in any way. And that's how she finds herself in this kind of confusing position.
Now that you are a writer, both of essays, and you appear fairly regularly in The New Yorker, and you've published a first novel, what do you know that she doesn't know?
Oh, well, one thing that I know is I have a PhD and I've taught undergraduates and I know how hard it is. And a lot of her impatience and frustration with her professors, that was very uncomfortable for me to read as someone who is a teacher of undergraduates myself. I know that language is a convention and that we use it in different ways that we all agree on. She is someone who thinks that language is this direct expression of what is in your soul, or it's some direct expression of the truth. So she can't function in any number of situations. She can't go to a job interview because she goes to a job interview and they're like, what do we miss out on if we don't hire you? And she's like, she doesn't know that that's like a cliche, or that, you know, it doesn't occur to her, I guess, that they have to ask you something. So she's taking everything that everyone says at its surface value. And she's like, why would they ask me such a perverse question? Or, you know, everything that her professors say, she's like, wait, this is human knowledge? But it's not, you know, of course, the premise of every class isn't that as the professor, you're not thinking, I'm going to walk into this classroom and deliver human knowledge. Like, everything is just a work in progress. And she doesn't totally see that yet.
I'm talking to Elif Batuman. She's the author of The Idiot. She and Fyodor Dostoevsky have written books with the same title. We'll be back after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Elif Batuman about her latest book, The Idiot, about a young woman on the verge of life, discovering the internet, love, and discovering herself. Also, I'd say discovering herself at a time when the emphasis on self-discovery is starting to be a little bit de trop. I mean, what is there to discover when you discover yourself?
I think there's a line where they're in the supermarket and they see a magazine called Self, and Ivan says, what are they going to tell me that I don't already know?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, they're all Harvard undergraduates, so they're all extremely awkward people who had, you know, more or less reclusive childhoods. They've all discovered email at the same time. They're Ivan, like her, like Celine, is learning that he can use email to say things that he could never say in person. And he's finding this huge amount of freedom in that, which Celine is then interpreting everything that he says as if they're the words of a god or a monster.
There's been a shift.
Yeah.
Once, if you were writing a love note, you would write it for days.
Yeah.
And then recopy it onto the appropriate stationery.
Yeah.
And then very carefully choose a stamp for it. Once you have the internet, and this book charts the beginning of internet culture, the exchanges are going very quickly. So she knows somehow what a love letter in a great novel might sound like, but she hasn't written that yet. It's not in her bag of tricks. And so she's trying to answer these uninterpretable notes from Ivan, who was frequently saying things off the cuff that he doesn't mean, that have hurt her feelings. So she doesn't get to say, I love you very much. And he doesn't get to say somehow, I love being around you, although it's clear he does. And she can't believe he loves being around her because they don't do anything together that would be that enjoyable other than engage in hooded conversation.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing what this internet culture has done to human exchange.
Yeah. Another thing that felt really different to me rereading it was there's a conversation that she has with a therapist where she's trying to describe the whole situation. Like, first I'm writing these guy these emails and none of it makes any sense to, he's like, what? Like, who is this guy? Are you sure he's real? And it just is completely shattering to her. And she's like, I'm never going to go talk to that therapist. And the therapist's like, oh, I think this was a good chat, you know, talk to you next week. And she's like, whatever, I'm never going back there. And I remember writing that and all of my sympathy being on Celine's side. And I reread it as an adult and everything that therapist said was right. It's, you know, it's the crazy situation, but she's in a position that that truth can't be communicated to her in that way.
Yes, she can't hear it.
She can't hear it.
So I found this to be a very modern book about a woman fending her inherent sensitivity and intuition against the systems of intelligent thought that Harvard is telling her this is how the real world is structured. And she knows that however the real world may be structured, it's going to be restructured according to the dictates of her heart.
It's true. It's really true.
And our best educations are there to be embraced and savored and then put aside in favor of wisdom rather than education. That wisdom is equally hard won, and we yearn to achieve it,
Yeah, and there's no shortcut. You just get it through time and through, I think, through seeing things get outdated somehow. To me, that was a big part of it for me. And that was actually why Proust was so important to me, too, was because he described that some kind of wisdom or some kind of perspective only comes when the things that you thought were absolutely necessary and inflexible just turn out to have been contingent and arbitrary and just completely change. And you see how different things can be.
How much do you feel that you write out of the dictates of the heart?
I don't know that I think that you could separate the heart and the head or the heart from anything else. I mean, I guess 100% from the dictates of the heart, because I don't know. I'm only ever writing about things that I really care about and things that I experienced in some way. And even in the novel, I'm trying to find a different way at it. But with nonfiction, it was the same. With literary criticism, it was the same. I don't know, if there isn't that tie to the heart, then I have a hard time sustaining the interest.
One of the things that I admired about The Idiot is that it's a very funny book, and it's funny by way of breaking down pretensions and speaking with its feet firmly on the floor. It's not buying into the intellectual confusions that are being presented, because ultimately we are going to have to be ourselves after we survive the ambuscade, the really attacks on our selfhood that education brings.
Yeah, this is just reminding me of I don't know, all the stuff that I wrote about in my dissertation with the, the Hegel's master-slave dialectic. And there's the servant who has this visceral, real connection to life, which is like the students that we are. And then there's the master who has this remote, you know, area of knowledge that is disconnected from everything. And the master is more powerful than the servant. But I think what you have in the novel, I don't know, this is like Don Quixote. The reason Don Quixote is so great is it has Don Quixote, who's so educated and knows so much and can educate Sancho Panza. He's going to tell Sancho Panza everything. And then, but Sancho Panza is the one who has his feet on the ground, and who, and yet Sancho takes Don Quixote really seriously. Like he listens to all of those stories that he tells, and they take each other seriously. And that's what makes their interaction funny and not dismissive. That's what makes it so rich. And I think in a way I tried to do that in the Idiot too. Even in the parts where she sees that things are pretentious and ridiculous. I mean, one thing that kind of struck me rereading it was how seriously she takes everything, even the things that I now would not take so seriously.
I've been speaking with Elif Batuman, author of The Idiot, published by Penguin Press, a very enjoyable and surprising skate along the turf of changing adolescence and how both to take it too seriously and not too seriously at the same time.
What a great description.
Thank you for joining me. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Idiot at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Today, Alan Howard is our producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just read this. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Julian Brulaski is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.